From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Herb Kohl wants more owners of the Bucks. We'll talk about what that means for their future. Then, a recent book chronicles the story of the honor flights that take World War II vets to Washington.
I think the beauty of a photography book is to really capture those unseen moments that may slip by. Honor Flight is about a big homecoming, a big send-off, and a lot of people have seen and experienced that in Milwaukee.
We'll talk with Milwaukee chef Sanford D'Amato about his new memoir, and we'll meet the modest young inventor of a combination sweatshirt and stuffed animal.
Yeah, it's really cool because I invented it with my brother and sister, and I just feel like I'm so famous. Even I am really famous, and so I am so proud of myself.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. With a discussion underway about Milwaukee's downtown sports arena, Milwaukee Bucks owner Herb Kohl has announced he's seeking additional owners for the franchise. In a statement released yesterday, the former U.S. senator said his effort to broaden the team's ownership is aimed at strengthening the team's financial position and to keeping it in Milwaukee.
I think the future of the Milwaukee Bucks today is a lot brighter than it was yesterday. I feel real strong about this opportunity that I'm going to be taking to engage in discourse about adding to the ownership of the Milwaukee Bucks as a way of strengthening the franchise, providing more stability, and even providing a more secure future for our existence here in Milwaukee.
Kohl says he purchased the team in 1985 in part to ensure the team remained here. But with uncertainty over the future of the BMO Harris Bradley Center or a possible replacement for it, questions have arisen about the long-term viability of the team in the city. Howie Magner was at Herb Kohl's press conference yesterday in St. Francis. He writes about sports for Milwaukee Magazine, and he's our regular sports contributor. Magner talked with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke about whether Monday's announcement brings the Bucks' future into any additional focus.
I don't know if you'd say it's a clearer focus because, frankly, I think it all still comes down to whether or not they will get a new arena. But I do think that it's a positive step forward because what I think Herb Kohl is doing here, in addition to kind of laying the foundation for the succession of the franchise, is he's kind of opening the door up to some allies in getting the arena built. One of the last questions that he was asked yesterday was whether or not he expected this new owner to be at the forefront of the effort to build a new arena. And he didn't necessarily demand that that would be the case, but he certainly sounded open to it. And whether or not that effort comes in the form of financial advice or financial backing or just being out there in the public eye, I think has to help because the more respected people that you have out there touting this thing, I think it increases the amount of success. And the more people that you would have out there willing to put their money into the pot has to help the effort to build the arena. So I certainly think his announcement yesterday didn't hurt. I do know that there's a segment of people who are have grown weary of Herb Kohl's ownership of the Bucks. I say that, and I certainly hope that the people who say those things recognize that without Herb Kohl, the Bucks are not here. Not only because he bought them back in the 80s, but because he has staved off interest from others many times over, and he's doing it yet again. He could sell this team to an out-of-state interest who would want to move it elsewhere overnight, and he would make a heck of a lot more money in doing so than he would by selling to somebody who would promise to keep it here. But he's not doing that, and he's not doing that because he loves the city and he wants the Bucks to stay in the city forever.
In some way, does it make it difficult to get that downtown arena thing to have the same kind of urgency without that threat of, you know, I could sell this to an out-of-state interest and it could leave?
Well, technically, I don't know that the threat's necessarily coming from him, although he's certainly complicit in it. It's really coming from the NBA. The NBA is saying, look, if you don't get a new arena here, it's not viable for the rest of our league and it doesn't fit our business model anymore. And we might kind of have to push you guys out. Herb Cole certainly realizes that. And I'm not saying that you know, he's kind of backed into a corner or anything like that. But I also think that he realizes from an NBA perspective that if he doesn't have the new arena for this team, then the team is playing the NBA game with one arm tied behind its back. So, you know, whether or not people out there want to agree with that, that certainly is their prerogative. But that is the case that the NBA is making. That is the case that Herb Cole is going along with. And therefore, those are the rules that the franchise has to play by. You know, and Milwaukee ends up, you know, having a decision to make. Do they want to play by those rules or do they want to say, no, we're not going to play by those rules? And if they don't want to play, that's certainly fine. The NBA will be happy to pony up another city and have the Bucks go play elsewhere.
Herb Cole has said in the past he is willing and plans to make a substantial contribution to a new arena. Does that remain the case even in the face of this announcement he's looking for new owners?
Absolutely. And I believe he said during his press conference yesterday that whether or not he was the majority owner of the Bucks, he planned on contributing to the new arena a significant amount. I wonder if the potential new investor or majority owner would take that same stance. What I have often thought, and this is through no inside information that I have or anything like that, is that Senator Cole has no obvious heirs to his vast fortune. I think in many ways the Milwaukee Bucks are his heir. And so I've really thought that if he sells the franchise to a new owner, that he will put a whole lot of that money into a new arena. Either that or he will sell the franchise below market value with the understanding that whoever buys that franchise below market value will put whatever money was saved on the purchase into the new arena. I just really think that he loves the franchise that much, he loves the city that much, that he's willing to put his money where his mouth is, so to speak.
What about names being mentioned as possible additional owners for this franchise? There are a few that get mentioned in a lot of places.
Well, I think the people's choice right now is Mark Attanasio, the Milwaukee Brewers owner, who has been very successful at kind of revitalizing that franchise. And I think people have seen what he has done with the Brewers, and they say, well, if he can do that with the Brewers, then why can't he do that with the Milwaukee Bucks? Now, he has publicly stated that there's nothing to those rumors, but of course he's going to say that publicly at this stage, I would think, when, you know, there's no public effort to sell the team. Has he had talks behind closed doors? There has been no mention of that. Herb Cole has said that there are no ongoing talks right now with any potential new investors. But you do kind of wonder if it wouldn't be intriguing to Mark Attanasio to kind of become the sports emperor of Milwaukee, if you would, in owning the two biggest professional the only two professional franchises in Milwaukee. I wonder if that would be tantalizing to him. I still don't know how realistic it is, but that certainly seems to be the people's choice right there. There are some other prominent businessmen out there who were mentioned. Ted Kellner, the founder of Fiduciary Management.
There are a couple of other sports owners that have been mentioned. The owner of the Lakeshore Chinooks, which is a Northwoods League collegiate level team, and also at least one of the owners of the Milwaukee Admirals has been mentioned.
Right. And Craig Leipold, who formerly owned the Nashville Predators of the NHL, currently owns the Minnesota Wild of the NHL. And I believe he's
from Racine.
Right, from Racine. I believe he's part of the Johnson fortune down there. Yep. 10 years ago, I think his name was one of the real hot names when it came to the next owner of the Bucks. I think that's kind of cooled. I believe he has said in the past or the more recent past that he is quite happy with being an NHL owner and that his interest in owning an NBA team has cooled. So it will be interesting. Will his interest be peaked again now that he knows that the team is up for sale, at least in part. I don't know.
Do we know anything about the size of the contribution that Herb Kohl is looking for? As you say, he talked about being a potential minority owner or staying a majority owner down the road.
He really demurred when it got into any specifics about that type of thing at his press conference. I personally get the feeling that this really had the feel of being the first time that Herb Kohl, in a public setting, looked like he was setting the stage for the succession of the franchise. And what I kind of think might happen is that the new owner comes in as a minority interest with the goal or the knowledge that eventually he or she will become the majority owner. That's just speculation on my part. It certainly could be an immediate go over to majority ownership. But what Senator Kohl did sound, he sounded open to possibilities yesterday. So I think his main goal is, and he said it several times yesterday, was to ensure that a new arena gets built and that the Bucks stay in Milwaukee and that whoever takes over the Bucks down the line will be as committed to keeping the team in Milwaukee as he is. Those are his main goals. And I think the rest of it is just kind of moving pieces around the chessboard and seeing what works.
No mention of trying to improve the Bucks beyond 5-19, though.
No, I think that's going to be a much tougher task this year than finding somebody to take over the Bucks. And he did say this, for folks who don't think that there is value in the Milwaukee Bucks and that there would be interest out there in the Milwaukee Bucks, he said every year he basically has somebody broach the subject. He says he hasn't gotten into any serious discussions about that. But there are people out there who will want to own the team. You make money on an NBA team. You may not make money year to year in a profit sense, but you certainly make money when you sell it to the next owner down the line.
Howie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he's senior editor at the magazine. He's also our regular sports contributor, and he talked with Mitch Tyke. You'll find a link to Bucks owner Herb Kohl's Monday announcement at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll switch gears next and hear about a recent book that documents the Stars and Stripe honor flights. They transport Wisconsin World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. For almost a decade, a group of volunteers has undertaken the task of allowing veterans of World War II to visit the Washington, D.C. monument that honors their sacrifice. Since its inception, the Stars and Stripes Honor Flight has flown more than 5,000 veterans from around Wisconsin to Washington. It's a very moving experience for the veterans and for the friends and family who welcome them back at the end of the day. The full experience is captured in a recent book of photographs called Honor Flight: Visual Journey. Honor Flight founder Joe Dean joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke, along with photographer Courtney Lutz, book editor Renee Riddle, and Dan Buttery, who's the president of Fisher House, Wisconsin, which shares in the proceeds from the book. Dean said there were many untold stories the book helped bring to light.
We were recently with a survivor of the USS Indianapolis, and it's a long story, but of the 1,200 men on board, 900 made it into the water, and after 4 days and nights of essentially shark attacks, 317 came out, and we met one of those heroes at a recent Honor Flight event. And after he told our story and we thanked him for his service, he said, you know, I think about those guys every single day. And he shook my hand and he said, but you know what? Freedom is worth it, isn't it? So that's kind of what we feel at Honor Flight. We're losing these heroes, 900 every single day. And we believe deep in our souls that freedom is worth it, and we need to do everything we can to thank them and honor them.
And I think the beauty of a photography book is to really capture those unseen moments that may slip by. Honor Flight is about a big homecoming, a big send-off, and a lot of people have seen and experienced that in Milwaukee. But what a still image does is it captures those quiet moments of reflection where our veterans are just staring at the memorial, holding hands with one of their escorts or guardians. And from the power of that image, you really get a moment of what they're thinking about, what they're remembering that happened to them 70 years ago, and how these trips bring back those memories for them.
And as the photographer, it must be a delicate balance between wanting to depict these very personal moments but not wanting to intrude on them. Did you worry ever that the lens is intruding on those moments?
No, not at all. I think that there's so many times throughout the day that we can be right next to the veterans, and they're very welcoming and thankful that we're there capturing the homecomings.
Yeah, and I think because Courtney and her team are with us from early in the morning, this day starts at 4:30 in the morning, and, you know, it's going through this big experience together. We're on a plane, we're waiting in lines, we're on the bus, and there's a rapport that develops throughout the day. So really by the middle of the day and by the end of the day, they feel like they are really good friends with the photographers who come with us.
Mitch, one of the things, I mean, we're so pleased to be partnered with Visual Image Photography, Courtney and her team. You really recognize when somebody's heart is in these pictures. And this book is a work of art and a labor of love from the people at VIP. And one of the things we learned along this journey through these pictures particularly was that as important as it was to thank these veterans, that we better never wait 70 years to thank them again. And that's one of the reasons we're so pleased to be partnered with the Fisher House right here in Wisconsin.
Well, right. And so why does Fisher House feel that it's important to be a partner with the Honor Flight?
Earlier this year, Joe and Renee reached out to us and said, look, we have to do our mission. We're going to continue the mission with Honor Flight. But we understand the pressing need in Milwaukee for the construction of the first Fisher House in the state of Wisconsin for these current veterans. Well, correction on that, all generations of veterans. And so it's not only the current combat soldier who's coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, but it's also the World War II Korean Vietnam veterans who are being treated at the Milwaukee VA. And so it really was a way to bridge the gap of generations between both organizations, but also to deal with a more immediate and pressing need that is currently serving a cause and a mission for our current military and veterans.
Now, you mentioned these really kind of solemn moments along the way, and I'm sure they're really happening all the time. But one of the things that struck me in looking at many of the pictures is that while it is a solemn occasion, at its heart, many, many of the veterans that you're bringing to Washington look like they're having a terrific time.
That's the best part of the day, are the surprises from when they are getting to the airport in the morning and there's people there welcoming them and helping them. And then they get to Dulles and there's a huge crowd at Dulles. And it just keeps happening. Even at the World War II Memorial, people, random strangers will come up to them and greet them and thank them. And those are the special moments and those are the happy moments and all the way to the end of the day.
Some of them look like they're really hamming it up.
They do. You're going to see a lot of smiles with each page turn in this book. I think some of the most powerful images, too, are the ones that connect the generations. There are so many kids and young people who are really, really connecting to this greatest generation. And to see the signs and the hugs and the tears that they have for these heroes, it's really overwhelming. And we can't totally explain it at Honor Flight, but it's amazing that through the power of the lens, we've been able to capture it.
So many of these veterans have never talked about their experience before. And they join us on an Honor Flight, and it becomes this fountain of youth where they really revert back to the 18, 19, 20-year-olds they were when they defended this nation. And we find that that's very cathartic. They begin sharing stories first with each other, and then ultimately we hear from their families that when they get home, most of them for the first time in their lives begin to also share their stories with family members.
Well, and it seems remarkable that, I mean, for all the stories we feel like we have heard about World War II, there are so many more stories that we haven't heard.
That's right. And again, one of the reasons we're so pleased to be working with the Fisher House is that Fisher House talks about family's love is good medicine. And bringing these families together is really a part of the healing process. And those stories are also shared with each other at the Fisher House, right?
It is. And there's been a development as we've been moving forward with our capital campaign for private funds in Milwaukee to build the Fisher House at the Milwaukee VA. It's an interesting connection between recent passing of some of these veterans, because what will happen is there will be gifts made in honor and memorial. And we receive those, but they're also accompanied by handwritten notes of these family members of these World War II veterans and these Korean and Vietnam veterans. But there were a couple notes that came in from a veteran who passed away from Cudahy, who was in the Battle of Midway on one of the carriers. And these are our neighbors. And very few people knew he was here about his story until he passed, and then they selected Fisher House to be their gift in memory of their father and their grandfather because of the honor. And I will tell you, it's a powerful moment when you get this note. Or from a spouse and saying the love of her life has passed, but she loves and honors everything that he represented for her and the nation. And so you can see it's a natural connection between what the Honor Flight's doing and honoring World War II and now Korean veterans, and then what we're doing to support them now with the need of coverage, health, you know, while they're getting their health and treatment at the VA so their loved ones are close to them.
There is a moment depicted in this book. It's a photograph from Arlington National Cemetery of I think she was a World War II nurse who had dressed up to visit her late husband, thinking of it as going on one last date with him. And it was hard to look at. It was so moving.
Yeah, that was Lucy Cohen. She was an awesome individual and spent a lot of her formative teen years, late teen years, on the front lines in Germany in a ward for what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder individuals. And it changed her life. She came back to work in the mental health field. But that's a very powerful picture.
What was the greatest challenge in both turning this into a book and turning it into a book that was not 10,000 pages?
It was very difficult. We started with over 15,000 images from the last 5 years of honor flights. And it took us months to cull through these images and pare them down. And I still think there's about another 1,000 that we could have added.
<That's right. laughs>
The cover image, I think, says it all. You see a whole row of sailors from Great Lakes Naval Base. They come up and they've been doing this for many of our homecomings. These young sailors volunteer their time, they come up and they'll stand in a solemn salute, and our World War II veterans get to walk through this row of saluting sailors, and wow, is that a moment. And I've seen many a World War II veteran come off that plane and just have to stop, wipe away the tears, and they salute back. And those of us that are volunteering or the guardians to these veterans, that's a powerful moment. And that's why we picked it to be the cover of this book.
Yeah, there's some great behind-the-scenes pictures that most people never see about Honor Flight. And Renee mentioned, you know, the sense of community and how the community came together. That really is also the story of Honor Flight. This way, we started with a brat fry, right, and raised $250. And as this book goes to press, we've flown 5,000 veterans from around Wisconsin, and that's in thanks to 600 volunteers and just the remarkable support of this community. I think we really touched a nerve because this is everyone's history.
A perfect note to end on. Thank you to all four of you. Best of luck with
Mitch,
this book.
Yeah, I just want to add, Mitch, that again, thanks to Dan and the Fisher House, half the proceeds from this book will go toward building this Fisher House. I think we're going to try to break ground in the spring, correct, Dan?
April, May is the timeline that we'll be breaking ground.
So we need to raise significant money to help our partners at the Fisher House. No one will regret owning this book. They will pass it on from generation to generation. We're a 100% volunteer-run organization, and 50% of all the proceeds will go to us to continue to fly veterans, and 50% will go to the good people at the Fisher House.
Well, Joe, Dan, Renee, Courtney, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Dean is the founder of Stars and Stripes Honor Flight. Dan Buttery is president of the board at Fisher House, Wisconsin. Courtney Lutz is a photographer whose work comprises the book Honor Flight, A Visual Journey. And Renee Riddle edited the book. In addition to being available at local bookstores, you can also find it today at the lower level of the Milwaukee County War Memorial from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. There is a link to more information about that at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Milwaukee's fine dining scene has changed a lot in the past 30 years. We'll talk with Chef Sanford D'Amato about it and his recent book, When Lake Effect Continues, on WUWM. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. One of the key people responsible for the rise of Milwaukee's fine dining scene over the past three decades is chef and Milwaukee native Sanford D'Amato. The James Beard Award-winning chef founded and owned Sanford Restaurant for 23 years. He was the first American chef to break into the French-controlled kitchens of New York in the 1970s, and he recently released his memoir with recipes called Good Stock, Life on a Low Simmer. Just after the book's release last month, Chef D'Amato stopped by to chat and told us that food had always been a part of his life.
My mother was an amazing cook, and then my grandfather was too. It was kind of funny with my grandfather because he was not the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book,
right? But when he was working with food, there was this like dreamy smile that you just never saw that would come over his face. That was the only time. It seemed like it was the only time he was really, really happy. And he had said he really wanted to be a chef. And he had never, you know, he had just never had that chance to do that. He became a grocer. And it was funny because he died before I got out of cooking school. I was cooking at the time, which he was really happy about. And,
but he never got to see what you achieved, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, well, it is. But the good part of it, I think, that he would really enjoy is the dishes that he did over the years that I incorporated into our food, both just making it at home but at Sanford too.
So how did growing up in Milwaukee at the time that you did, in this family that you did, affect the chef that you are now? I mean, what is it about this Milwaukee experience?
Well, I mean, everything that I've done over my life has been done here. You know, I mean, from the first time I cooked to my first kiss, my first, you know, everything was in this city. And at the time that I was getting into cooking, my father, he talked to the PAP salesman. He had the grocery store, and that's actually where Sanford Restaurant came from. It was my grandfather's and father's grocery store over on Jackson and Pleasant. He told me about a place called Kultz, which was an older German restaurant over on Oakland and Locust. And that's kind of where I started. They're doing Friday night fish fries, which every good Milwaukee cook or chef should know how to do, breading onion rings. And after I was working at Kultz for a while, I wanted to get into some kind of a program. And back in the late 60s, there really weren't a lot of programs to get into. And I found out about one from the Jewish Vocational Services. The best part of it was that it was free. And so it was at a downtown building in Milwaukee, right on Wisconsin Avenue. So I went down there about 6 o'clock. And, of course, all the buildings at that time were pretty much deserted at 6 o'clock. And it was a kind of a creepy feeling going up the elevator and getting in. But there was this class and just in one of the offices up there. It was run by a chef from Strussell's at that time, which was like a prime rib place over on the west side. It was Tom Radcliffe. And he had a group there, and I was the youngest by probably 15 to 20 years.
That was and so how old were you at this point?
I was 19.
Okay.
18, 19, right around that. Anyway, he was teaching, and he was a great teacher. But during the class, it seemed like none of the students were really that interested in the class. And I was expecting this kind of, you know, camaraderie of talking to all the students, and afterwards we'd talk cooking or go get some coffee somewhere, or I couldn't drink at that time. But this never happened. So after about 3 months, Chef Radcliffe called me into his office after class. He asked me if I could stay, and I did, and I didn't know if that was like a good or bad thing. But he's talking to me afterwards. He said, you're really interested in cooking, aren't you? And I said, well, yeah, isn't everyone here? I mean, that's why we're here, to learn to be chefs. And he said, you don't know, do you? And I said, no, what? And he said, you're the only one here that doesn't have to be here. Everyone else is on work release from prison. So that was my first cooking school experience. So he's the one who told me about different options and told me about the Culinary Institute. And that's how I ended up going out there when they first moved from Yale's, they were on Yale's campus in New Haven to Hyde Park.
And then, of course, you're in New York and you're the first American to kind of break into that very French world at the time of fine dining cuisine. I imagine that, you know, the techniques that you learned and the way to run a kitchen were things that you still use today. How much of that is incorporated into the cuisine that eventually became your signature?
Oh, it's all part of it. You know, every chef has a cooking signature of what they do. And it comes from their technique that they learn. And that's what I learned from, you know, working for the French chefs in New York, and what I learned for working for my other mentor, Peter Van Erp, who was a Dutch chef who I worked with at the Culinary Institute. And then they have their palate, which can range from any part of the palate. It can be some chefs go to the acid side, some chefs go to the sweet side, some are bitter. But it's all that incorporation that if you give one dish to five different chefs, you're going to get five different dishes. And if you know those chefs, if you know their food, you're going to know whose dish is whose just by the taste of that dish, because every dish becomes kind of a template of their journey, of where they've been and sometimes where they're going. And then the other part of your signature is your taste memories. And that's, I think, is the most important part. And it's really what makes distinctive food, because my taste memories are completely different from yours. So when you're looking at a dish, if people would incorporate that into their food, everybody would have really, really distinctive, delicious food. Everybody doesn't do that. I mean, now it's become almost kind of chic to go on and find what the new hot dish is and just take a recipe off the internet and make it. But what that becomes a recipe, and I tell everybody that works for me over the years, I mean, recipes are, they're really soulless frames without knowing where the food came from. And that's really what the book is about, is the stories, because without the stories, there is no food. There are no recipes.
And you incorporate all of these wonderful recipes. And I think about you say, of course, my taste memories are different from yours. But it seems that what you're offering here is a way for me to kind of get close to your taste memories.
Yes. Well, because, I mean, having said that with, the, you know, that recipes are soulless frames, I mean, I better figure out a way in the book to put some soul into them so that people buying the book and making the recipes have an idea of what I'm thinking of when I'm making it and the technique that I put into it. So that's what I feel the story does. But it gives every reader the freedom to take that recipe and put themselves into it, which is going to probably make it different from what I would do, but possibly better.
And one of the things that really struck me that you said in one of the first little stories in the book of never forgetting that part of your job is to make the people eating your food as happy mm-hmm. as you are when you are making the food. And do you think that's something that we're missing a lot of times, that chefs forget that part of the job is to make people eating their food happy?
Well, it's very easy to get isolated in a kitchen and to not realize that there's someone eating your food. This isn't an ego trip. I mean, this is about comfort, and this is about making people happy. And as a chef, it's really important to understand that. And what I try to do at the restaurant, what we tried to do over the years at the restaurant, was to have everyone that worked in the kitchen and everyone that worked in the dining room too come in for dinner and to sit down and to actually be a customer and to see the food from a different perspective, that you realize that after a night of doing 100 people, when you're putting out that last dish, that person doesn't care that you've just put out 55 dishes. It's that person being there for the first time. It's kind of like I like to use a baseball analogy of, I mean, a great hitter, I mean, Ted Williams, one of the great hitters of all time, batted 405. I mean, if I batted 405 cooking, I'd be out of a job. I mean, nine hundred doesn't make it. Every dish has to be perfect when it goes out for a customer, because a customer doesn't care that nine other people got a great dish and they got a lousy one.
As you were choosing the recipes here, how did you pick them? How did you go through? Because I imagine there are many favorites that you have and things that bring back stories and memories for you that you would have liked to have included but didn't have room for.
Well, it was because of the stories. The stories brought about the recipes that are in the book. The last 10 recipes, because people always say, what are your favorite recipes? And so I compiled those in the last 10 recipes in the book. Those are my desert island recipes that I would have to eat for the rest of my life. You know, the spadini, you know, Sicilian spadini, the cookies, you know, having the pecan and brown sugar cookies, and those are all my favorite. Those are my favorite things. But all the other recipes have, you know, from the chicken pastina soup in the beginning to my my variation on my mother's cinnamon ribs. It runs the gamut of simple to the ginger snap cannoli that did for Julia Child's 80th birthday. And that was really the transition dish when we opened Sanford between the grocery store and the restaurant.
Well, now that Sanford has a new owner and you are moving on to other things, you've got the book, you're still cooking, of course. As you look back at sort of the trajectory of Milwaukee's fine dining, we're getting recognition, but I'm curious where you think we're going.
Well, what's happening, and it isn't unique to Milwaukee. It's unique to the whole country right now, is when I moved back to Milwaukee in 1980 and I left New York, it was a big decision because I was leaving the epicenter of food in the world. And I was a pretty competitive guy, but I was looking for balance in my life. And I wanted to come back here for two reasons. One of them was for that balance, for relationships and to have a normal life. And the other one was I wanted to open up a restaurant. And I knew in New York I could open a restaurant, but I'd never own the restaurant because I'd never have that kind of money. What has happened since that time is that the rest of the country, the coasts, the media coasts, discovered that there was something in between and that there was great food all around the country. And it made it possible for chefs to move back to wherever they were from and to be able to do that and to be able to do the food that they want to do and to be able to survive. And that's what's happening in the city right now. There's not only chefs that are from here that have gone away and then come back, but there's other chefs that are just moving here that realize that this is a great, you know, it's a great way to live. It's a great lifestyle, but they can do the kind of food that they want to do and that they can survive and that people are going to support them.
So is there a signature Milwaukee style for somebody who's looking from the outside in?
I think people incorporating parts of the Midwest into their food, but it depends on their background too. You know, like Justin, who took over Sanford. I mean, he's bringing his Armenian background into the food, but he's also using all the products of the state. You know, it's really kind of funny talking about farm to table now that it is, you know, like, I mean, it is a signature byword of restaurants. I mean, that's the way food always was. It was always farm to table when it started out, because the only place that you could get product before it was shipped was you had to go to the farmer's market. And that's what restaurants ran on. I mean, and it was only in the 70s when flying fish started that they actually started flying food around the country where you could get things from outside of the country even brought in. And that's not, I mean, it's, you know, 40, 50 years ago, but it's still very recent. I mean, in the 70s, cooking in New York, we had asparagus in spring. We only had salmon, fresh salmon in spring. There was no other time of the year where there was fresh salmon around. And a lot of chefs are doing this now, but they're cooking that way. Even though you can get strawberries all year round, you want to get strawberries in that, you know, that end of May, beginning June when they're the best and when they're local, when they're so fragile that they can't be shipped. People are starting to get it.
So what's next for you?
Well, for us, we have a place out in Hatfield, Massachusetts. It's right in between Northampton and Amherst, right on the Connecticut River. We're going to have a small cooking school, like, you know, hands-on 10 to 12 people at a time in our home. So we're building that right now. And then we've already planted, starting 4 years ago, planting the whole that area of the little under the 2 acres. And so we'll be able to go out and get asparagus or rhubarb, or we have 16 fruit trees that we planted. So it's all starting to come around right now. So the classes will be run around what is fresh at that time.
So training the next generation.
Exactly. And that's what you should do. One other baseball analogy, you know, you peak, you know, sometimes when you're, you know, in your 30s and then you become the wily veteran. You know, if you're still pitching when you're 40s, you're usually a freak of nature. But after that, you get into coaching and you get into managing and you get into teaching. I'm not going to stop cooking. That's my life. But I'll just be able to pass it on.
Well, Sandy D'Amato, it has been such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. Thanks for having me here.
Award-winning chef and restaurateur Sanford D'Amato was born and brought up in Milwaukee. His new book is called A Memoir with Recipes. The actual title is Good Stock, Life on a Low Simmer. It's published by Agate Midway Publishing in Chicago. Our interview with him first aired last month, but D'Amato will talk about his book and sign copies tonight at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. There is more information about that at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break and then meet the Milwaukee family that has invented the next must-have gift for the kids in your life. It's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Every year, there are some trendy, kitschy gifts for kids that make their way under Christmas trees around the country. Things like the wearable blanket known as the Snuggie. And then there are items that are there year in and year out, like the good old-fashioned stuffed animal. More recently, a Milwaukee-area mom and her kids are behind an item that combines the warmth and softness of a sweatshirt with kids' love for stuffed animals. Louise Kempa and her children Seth, Alexia, and Alba devised the Hoodie Pet, a fleece shirt with a detachable animal. And the invention has gained national attention from toy companies and talk shows alike. Louise and 8-year-old Alexia joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke recently in the studio and talked about the inspiration for the Hoodie Pet.
The idea came from Seth and Alexia and Alba. I have a little 4-year-old. At that time, she was 2 years old. They were snuggling up in the sofa with Alba's really cozy blanket. And then Seth and Alexia really wanted to have something in that material, but they wanted to have something that was a little bit more grown up as a hoodie or something like that. So Alexia's idea was to do a hoodie out of it. And so I sew a hoodie out of a blanket material for them. And then when we were done with the hoodie, she told me that she wanted to add her extra pet. It's a little pet that attaches to the front pocket on the hoodie. And when I attached that and made a hoodie for all three kids, they said, but mommy, we wanted to trade them, play with them, and collect them. So then we put Velcro on the backside of every pet, so now the children can trade them with each other, play with them as finger puppet, and also collect them, all different pets, because there are 11 different pets they can choose from.
So it was that easy. You just thought, I wanted a hoodie, but I wanted a stuffed animal attached to it?
Yeah.
A lot of people might have had ideas for something they could imagine. I mean, did you think, okay, I have this, I bet my friends would want something like this too?
Yes, because I know that almost like all my friends love animals and they like sweaters too. I told them that I made this idea up and I used it from a blanket and a stuffed animal.
A lot of people might have this idea, and obviously Alexia and her brother and sister were in good shape because you could make something like this.
Yep.
But how much did you know about what it would take to get a whole lot of them made? I mean, basically take something from an idea to having a product that you could sell.
When I saw these hoodies, the children went to school with them. And every child wanted to have, they came back to me. I had mothers phoning me and say, hey, can you sew one for my child? And in the beginning, I did. And then I got a seamstress that was helping us out, sewing up around 15 of them. And then we did pilot tests. Is this going to work or not? And then we did some changes on them. Children wanted to have a thumb hole to stick their thumb holes in.
Those thumb holes are really trendy.
Yeah, thumb holes is a great thing. And also we had fur around the hood before, and we took that away just because now you can wear them both summer and winter and all year round. So we did do testing on them very much, and we did testing with moms also, what they would buy it for, how easy they are to wash, and what animals we should take. But Alexia, she picked all the animals, and Seth is more into working with the website.
Well, so Alexia, how did you decide which animals you wanted?
Well, I chose from my favorite animals, and I also named the animals.
All right. Well, so give us an example. What kind? Give us the full line, because there are what, 10 of them? 11?
Yeah, 11. There's Grizzy the bear, Bambooey the panda, Barky the puppy, Bouncy the bunny, Arky the polar bear, Clawy the tiger, Minnie the bunny, Screamy the ape, Speedy the cheetah, Unity the unicorn, and Zoli the zebra.
Well, and it would be one thing to be able to put the hoodies together, but you would also have to have a ready supply of mm-hmm. the animals. How did
yes.
you go about finding the right animals to go with the hoodies?
You know what? We were working with a lot of children, very much feedback in different ages. Alexia took out the first, like, 7 animals, and then we said, okay, what animals more do we want to have? Every child wrote it up. We have a Facebook page also. They came with many ideas. We're now going to make soon 3 more pets because we have a demand on it. So we designed all the Alexia was drawing them, and then we send them to our supplier that is in China, and they saw it up to us, and then we said, good, or tweak it a little bit more. We had a puppy that was blue before, and the children said, no, we want to have a real-time animal. So we changed them to brown and white instead.
Did you find, were you making essentially making up the business of this as you went along?
Yes, absolutely. This is a completely new for me to work with apparel. I love working with children, so that was not new for me. On the way, I have learned so much things with marketing and also feedback from customer. I love our customers because they give us so much good feedback and also what we can do that they want to do to make everybody happy.
What's been the hardest part about this?
Selling.
That was going to be my question. I mean, well, not, I
no,
mean,
in it, the beginning, that is true because nobody knew about us. And coming out, there were friends having them and they were very... We were very happy because they were recommending us and so on. And so in the first time, I mean, before a product get known, it's really hard to get out there. Now we have been fortunate that we have been on the Stevie Harvey show, NBC, and Milwaukee has been fantastic. We have been on different TV channels here in Milwaukee also.
Well, and so what was it like, the Steve Harvey show, for people that might not know it, it's a national talk show.
Yes.
What was that experience like?
I was not on the TV. That was Seth and Alexa, and then they did a phenomenal work.
Well, we laid out all the hoodies and the pets, and then we have, like, this big hoodie pet and this, like, statue thingy. And, like, there's this huge pet that goes with it.
Well, and were you nervous going on TV?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I imagine an experience like that and the various other shows that you've been on makes the distribution and reaching your potential
absolutely.
Customers much easier.
And also we were, Seth and Alexia, we got a phone call and an email saying they were nominated for the Taggarty Award. It's a big toy award that is nationwide and it's inventors from all over the world. And Mattel and Hasbro and Chicago Toy and Game, they nominated us, and getting a nomination from Hasbro and Mattel is awesome. And then they invited us to come to the big gala that was 800 people, and Seth and Alexia won the award for Young Inventors of the Year. And that after that, it has been pretty easy to sell.
I bet it has. Well, and so along those lines, I mean, is it at all difficult to keep up with demand?
It is. It is. We are selling out in some colors, and then we have to reorder, restock, and it's a fine line there. How much shall we take in? Everything is a cost.
Yeah. Right. You have to weigh the how much you have on hand versus
exactly.
Well, and so are you in stores? Are you mostly internet or a little of both?
We're in local stores, and we also are at Made for Mall, and you can also go to hoodiepet.com.
And one thing we are very happy about
is that we are selling hoodie pets at the Humane Society.
It was we love animals, and we love children, as you know, and we got in contact with them because I was on their big gala one night and because of supporting the Wisconsin Humane Society, and they have heard about the hoodie pet, and after that, then we had a meeting.
Well, and so, Alexia, is it exciting to see your friends wearing this thing that you invented?
Yeah, it's really cool because I invented it with my brother and sister, and I just feel like I'm so famous. Even I am really famous, and so I like am so proud of myself.
I think you should be.
So cute. Huh?
Well, and so let's say you get invited to a birthday party. Do you give your friends hoodie pets for presents, or have they already all gotten hoodie pets?
They usually have them, but some of my friends don't have them.
And then we come with extra pets or something.
Do you still have those first hoodie pets that you sewed?
I do.
How much do they look like what's for sale now?
Pretty much the same. The pets are much better. And they had fur, and we took that away. And they are much more professionally sewn, and that because I'm not so good in sewing, to be honest. I just thought this was for my children, but that's why I took in a seamstress also.
But now is the whole thing sourced in China now?
Yes,
okay.
It is.
And you know, you've developed this. People can customize it themselves. Are you thinking about the next thing? I mean, is this likely to be part of your life for a while? I mean, is Hoodie Pet going to diversify and add new products?
Yes, and we're also going to have a purse with an attachable pet now, and it's coming out in 1 week.
And also one thing we can tell that is very fun, we have been working a lot with our website, so it's kids-friendly. So all the pet comes with secret code. So if they have, when they get the hoodie pet, they will have a little secret code. They punch it in on the kids' side on hoodie pet, and the pet will jump up to the habitat where it belongs. And then it can get coloring pages, adoption certification, learn more about the animal, and just have fun on the pet's website.
And I think you said that's one of the things that Seth is
yes.
Involved with.
Yes, Seth is very involved with that. He's the internet guy, as they say.
How old is he?
He's 10 years old.
Which is not a bad distinction to have if you're 10 years old.
Yeah. Alexia Moore designs everything. She designs all the purses that are coming now. They're coming out in 4 different colors. And Seth is on the web.
Well, and so, Alexia, you're an inventor at a very young age. Is this going to be what you do when you grow up?
Yes, I think it's what I'm going to do. So I love design because I love art, and I also love sketching. And, like, everybody in my class thinks I'm so good at sketching stuff, and they're always asking, can you sketch this for me?
Well, you've got a really good start, and it sounds like a great future ahead of you. Alexia Louise Kempa, thank you so much for spending some time with us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Louise Kempa and her daughter Alexia are two of the inventors, along with siblings Seth and Alba, of the Hoodie Pet, a sweatshirt with a detachable stuffed animal. They spoke with Mitch Teich, and there are links to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air comes your way next. Stay tuned.